Thank you so much, Victoria, for the privilege of inviting me to be here today. Can you hear me? Oh, good. And I apologize that I cannot speak to you in Spanish. It's a terrible American limitation. I'm very honored to give these lectures. I feel it's a great privilege to be here in Barcelona. I thank you all for coming to hear me. I look forward to having a conversation with you. My lecture tonight is called Moral Injury and the Ethic of Care. And this is my latest thinking, an insight that I just really came to this year that I want to share with you. It's 40 years now since John Berger wrote, quote, "Never again will a single story be told as though it's the only one." It's 30 years since In a Different Voice transposed the conversation about self and morality from a conversation about rules and principles to a conversation about voices and relationships. It's 15 years since Arundhati Roy, in her novel The God of Small Things, coined the phrase love laws for the laws that establish, quote, who should be loved and how much, and showed that these love laws, often serve to justify violence. In the interim, a paradigm shift has been spreading through the human sciences. A growing body of evidence coming from developmental psychology, neurobiology, and evolutionary anthropology has led what had been taken as markers of development to be seen in a new light. Rather than signifying healthy forms of maturation, the separation of the self from relationships and of thought from emotion signal injury or responses to trauma. The primatologist Franz De Waal has called for, quote, a complete overhaul of assumptions about human nature to correct for the past emphasis on competition and aggression, and in light of the recognition that empathy is part of our evolutionary history and not just a recent part, but an age-old capacity, end quote. The evolutionary anthropologist Sarah Blaffer-Hurdy observes that the capacity for mutual understanding, by which she means empathy, mind reading, and and cooperation, was and may well be key to our survival as a species. The neurobiologist Antonio Damasio writes that our nervous systems are wired to connect thought and emotion. In our bodies and our emotions, we pick up the music, or what he calls, quote, the feeling of what happens, which then plays in our minds and thoughts. When we separate our minds from our bodies and divide our thoughts from our emotions, we can reason deductively and solve logical problems, but we lose our ability to register our experience and therefore to think inductively, to make decisions and navigate the human social world. These changes in our understanding of who we are as humans were sparked initially by listening to women. The, quote, different voice sounded different and was heard as, quote, feminine because it joined emotion with thought and relationships with self, because it was embodied rather than disembodied, located in time and place. I wrote In a Different Voice to show how women's what had been described by psychologists as a problem in women's development was in fact a problem in the framework of interpretation. To show that empathy and caring and what we now call, quote, emotional intelligence, used to be called feminine intuition, are in fact human strengths. With this shift in the framework, the different voice no longer sounds different. It is simply a human voice. In my lecture tonight, I will consider the implications of this paradigm shift for thinking about ethics and moral development. For example, in the 1980s, when researchers began to observe babies, not alone, but in relationship with their mothers, they saw an infant they had not imagined, a baby actively seeking and engaged in responsive relationships. From a very early age, practically from birth, human babies scan faces, make eye contact, and engage the attention of others. They register the difference between the experience of relationship, that is, being in touch with another person, and the appearance of relationship, that is, when somebody who seems to be relating to them is in fact out of touch. In the words of Daniel Stern, the human infant's world is, quote, an interpersonal world. With these observations, questions about development reverse. Rather than asking how do we gain the capacity to care, how do we learn to take the point of view of the other and overcome self-interest, we are prompted to ask how do we lose the capacity to care? What inhibits our ability to empathize with others and pick up the emotional climate around us? How do we fail to recognize the difference between being in and out of touch? And most painfully, how do we lose the capacity to love? As humans, we are responsive, relational beings born with a voice, with the ability to communicate, and the desire to live in relationships, along with the capacity to spot false authority. Within ourselves, therefore, we have the requisites both for love and for citizenship in a democratic society. The culture wars in the United States that began in reaction to the democratic advances of the 1960s are fights over the framework. As President Obama said in his campaign for re-election, quote, "This election offers the American people the choice between two very different visions of our future. Are you on your own, or are we in it together? Are you alone, or are we interdependent?" The reality is we're in it together because, as the poet W.H. Auden reminds us, no one exists alone. Hunger allows no choice to the citizen or the police. We must love one another or die. I will begin then with a discussion of moral injury, the shattering of trust that compromises our ability to love. Next, I will present a triptych of research on development showing when and how and why our humanity is at heightened risk and highlighting a capacity for resistance. Finally, I will take up the love laws as no small thing and not a private matter. As the battles over the love laws make plain, the cultural laws, remember the love laws, who can be loved and how much. These are the battles in the States over gay marriage and abortion, all these issues that used to be over race and so forth. As the battles over the love laws make plain, the culture wars are a fight between democracy and patriarchy. The ethic of care and its concern with voice and with relationships is the ethic of love and of democratic citizenship. It is also the ethic of resistance to moral injury. Part 1, moral injury. In his book, Achilles in Vietnam, the psychiatrist Jonathan Shea writes about moral injury. As a psychiatrist working with combat veterans, Vietnam combat veterans, he recognized in their post-traumatic stress disorders an injury that had not been identified or described, namely, a shattering of trust that followed the betrayal of what's right in a high-stakes situation where the betrayal was sanctioned by those in authority. Shea finds that healing from trauma depends on what he calls, quote, communalization of the trauma, being able safely to tell the story to someone who is listening and who can be trusted to retell it truthfully to others in the community. So, he advises, before analyzing, before classifying, before thinking, before trying to do anything, we should listen. Just listen, the veterans say, when telling mental health professionals what they need to know to work with them, meaning take in the story before trying to make sense of it. Because in fact, their stories don't make sense. They are stories about confusion, about becoming, quote, confused, where the confusion starts, quote, working on your head because, quote, you know in your heart it's wrong and you're told by your superiors that it's okay. And it's not just okay, this is the veterans, but rewarded with medals of honor. In the words of one veteran, these stories are, quote, sacred stuff. All too often, as Shea observes, quote, our mode of listening deteriorates into intellectual sorting, with the professional grabbing the veteran's words from the air and sticking them into mental bins. That is, we assume we know what we're hearing, that we don't really have to listen, that we've heard it all before. Thus, Shea writes, we resemble museum goers whose whole experience consists of mentally saying, that's Cubist, that's El Greco, and who never see anything they've looked at. As Shea notes, listening in this way destroys trust. I am struck by Shea's observations about listening because they so closely parallel the approach I have taken in my research. Listening in a way that creates trust was essential to hearing a different voice, meaning a voice that didn't make sense according to the prevailing categories of interpretation. The mode of listening was so integral to the process of discovery that my graduate students and I created a listening guide to specify a method other researchers could follow. But I am startled by the resonances I find in Shea's descriptions of moral injury. In the very different context, in the radically different context of studying development, children and adolescents, my colleagues and I had observed something akin to moral injury, that is, a shattering of trust following a betrayal of what's right in a high-stakes situation where the betrayal was culturally sanctioned and socially enforced. We were not observing combat injury. We were witnessing a process of initiation that is often mistaken for development, an initiation that is driven by gender and, more specifically, by codes and scripts of what it means to be a real man or a good woman. Speaking of what's right, Shea notes that no single English word takes in the whole sweep of a culture's definition of right and wrong. We use terms such as moral order, convention, normative expectations, ethics, and commonly understood social values. The ancient Greek word that Homer used, themis, encompasses all these meanings. What's right is Shea's equivalent of themis. It captures more closely than terms like moral order or ethics the sense of an inner compass we carry with us that alerts us when we've lost our way, when we're doing something that in our hearts we know is wrong. My observation of something akin to moral injury began with the studies of girls' development that followed in a different voice. The research highlighted an intersection in girls' lives at adolescence where an inner compass pointed in one direction and the highway signs in another. Girls had to throw away or ignore their compasses in order to follow the prescribed route with conviction. In their reluctance to do so, my research team and I saw a resistance that was associated with psychological resiliency and strength. But the intersection itself was marked by confusion because at this juncture in development, The very meaning of what's right was shifting. The right way to go was not the right way to go. The tension between psychological development and cultural adaptation became manifest as a crisis of connection, where having a voice, meaning being able to say what one is thinking and feeling, came into conflict with having, quote, relationships. Iris, a high school senior, reflects, quote, "If I were to say what I was feeling and thinking, no one would want to be with me. My voice would be too loud." And then she adds, by way of explanation, "But you have to have relationships." How could she say what she was feeling and thinking and also have relationships? But if she was not saying what she was feeling and thinking, then where was she in these so-called relationships? The interesting thing is, girls saw the paradox. Judy of 13 describes the pressure she feels to, in her words, quote, "forget your mind." Your mind, she says, pointing to her gut, is associated with your heart and your soul and your internal feelings and your real feelings. Facing the quandary of how to stay in touch with what she knows and also with what is considered knowledge, she arrives at a creative solution. Judy separates her mind not from her body, but from her brain, which she locates in her head and associates with her smartness, her intelligence, and her education. People, she says, quote, "can control what they're teaching you and say, quote, this is right and this is wrong." That's control like into your brain, Judy says. But the feeling, she says, is, quote, "just with you." The feeling can't be changed by someone else who wants it to be this way. It can't be changed by saying, no, this is wrong, this is right, this is wrong. As the interview draws to a close, Judy states her theory of development. Really young children, she says, have mind more than anything else because, quote, "they don't have much of a brain." But then the brain starts to evolve, and that's sort of like the way you're brought up. And I think that after a while, you just sort of forget your mind because everything is being shoved at you into your brain. Judy is 13, a reflective eighth grader, struggling with dissociation and trying to hold on to what she knows. She contends with a voice that carries moral authority, a voice she experiences as intrusive and controlling. You can forget your mind, she says, but the deeper sort of knowing, the knowing she associates with her heart and her soul, and her real thoughts and feelings can't be changed by someone saying, no, this is wrong, this is right. However forceful the initiation, however linked with smartness, intelligence, and education and all they imply, the, quote, "feeling is just with you, a gut knowing, buried perhaps, but not lost." The research on development gives a slightly different shift, slant, to Shea's writings about moral injury. It picks up on something one of the veterans said. He knew in his heart that it was wrong. He was speaking about on an intelligence error they had killed some innocent fishermen and children. Deep assumptions of what's right and wrong, what's praiseworthy and blameworthy, are rooted not only in culture, but also in our humanity. Reflecting on his title, Achilles in Vietnam, Shea notes that, quote, "the specific content of the Homeric warrior's themis was always often quite different from that of American soldiers in Vietnam. But what has not changed in three millennia are violent rage and social withdrawal when deep assumptions of what's right are violated. We live in bodies and in cultures, but we also have a psyche, a voice, and a capacity for resistance. The psyche's responses to moral injury across time and cultures is violent rage and social withdrawal, and also, as Shea describes, going berserk, going crazy, because something happened that psychologically didn't make sense." Part two, a triptych of development. The word betrayal appears repeatedly in Niobe Way's book, Deep Secrets, used by adolescent boys in her studies to explain why they no longer have a best friend, why they don't tell their secrets to anyone. The betrayal itself is never quite specified, Justin describes it as something that, quote, just happens. He doesn't know if it's, quote, natural or whatever, but the shattering of trust is unmistakable. As Joseph says, quote, you can't trust nobody these days. Something had happened. Justin and Joseph were among the majority of the boys in Wei's studies, boys from a range of cultural backgrounds, Latino, Puerto Rican, Dominican, Chinese, African-American, Anglo, Muslim, Russian, and so forth, who, quote, spoke about having and wanting intimate male friendships and then gradually losing these relationships and their trust in their male peers. As a freshman and sophomore in high school, Mohammed spoke of telling his best friend all his secrets. When interviewed as a junior in high school, he says, quote, I don't know. Recently, you know, I kind of changed or something. Not that much, but you know, I feel like there's no need to. I could just keep my feelings to myself, you know. I'm mature enough. Fernando echoes his explanation. Asked what he sees as an ideal friendship, he begins, you've got to be funny, truthful. I just got to have fun with you, you know. But then he says more haltingly and with a question, you've got to, I guess, just be there for me, I guess. I don't want to sound too sissy-like. I think I've matured in certain ways. I know how to be more of a man. In the early high school years, the boys resist the gender binary that makes it sissy-like to depend on someone and want them to, quote, just be there for me. But by the end of high school, as Wei notes, emotional intimacy and vulnerability have taken on a gender, girly, and the sexuality, gay. Being a man then means being emotionally stoic and independent. Thus we see the effects of a gender binary and hierarchy where being a man means not being a woman or like a woman and also being on top. What previously had felt unimpeded, the trust and love, trust, respect, and love that 15-year-old Justin says is, quote, so deep it's within you, it's human nature, has become fraught. Justin doesn't know if the distance he now feels is, quote, natural or whatever. What he knows is, quote, it just happens. The boys in Way of Study know the value of close friendships. George says that without a best friend to tell your secret to, you would, quote, go wacko. Chen says that without a close friend, quote, you go crazy. Others describe how anger builds up inside them when they don't have a best friend to talk to. Some speak of sadness, loneliness, and depression. The research with girls, the centerpiece in the triptych, reveals the mechanism of betrayal, how it is enacted through a series of separations that create splits in the psyche. The head is divided from the heart, the mind from the body, and the embodied voice, the voice that carries the feeling of what happens, is separated from relationships. Tanya, at 16, reflects, quote, the voice that stands up for what I believe in has been buried deep inside me. A voice with integrity resides within herself, but its silence compromises her relationships and also her ability to participate as a citizen in a democratic society. Articulate girls such as Tanya and Judy describe their strategies of resistance, separating your mind from your education, taking an honest voice underground. When it becomes seemingly impossible to have a voice and also to have relationships, some form of psychic splitting is inescapable. I don't know, girls will say. I don't care, the boys in Wave Studies say. Yet the girls do know, and the boys do care, although they may need not to know or to show this. An injunction, don't, has come to stand between I and knowing or caring. The internalization of the gender binary and hierarchy marks the psyche's induction into a patriarchal order. Whenever you hear a gender binary, being a man means not being a woman or like a woman, and vice versa, and encounter a gender hierarchy that privileges the masculine, reason and self, over the feminine, emotions and relationships, you know you are in patriarchy, whatever it may be called. As an order of living based on age and gender, an order that privileges the voice and the law of the father, patriarchy is incompatible with democracy, which rests on a premise of equal voice or equality. But it is also in conflict with human nature. By bifurcating human qualities into, quote, masculine or feminine, it creates rifts in the psyche. The internalization of patriarchal norms and values, its codes and scripts of masculinity and femininity, thus forces a betrayal of what's right by compromising our ability to live with integrity in relationship with others. It forces a betrayal of love and of truth. To appreciate what is lost and why, one only has to listen to girls before the initiation sets in. In a discussion of whether it's ever good to tell a lie, an 11-year-old Elise, a sixth grader in an urban public school, says, quote, "My house is wallpapered with lies." Whenever people say to me, "We want girls to have their voices," I say, first of all, girls have their voices. Girls will tell you that. Secondly, do you really want to hear what they say? "My house is wallpapered with lies." When I went to Elise's house to get a permission slip signed, I saw what she was seeing, and I also saw her watching me see it. A surface of domestic tranquility was covering an explosive sexual triangle. Elise's voice is the voice of countless pre-adolescent girls in novels written across time and culture. At the beginning of Jane Eyre, Jane, age 10, tells her Aunt Reed, quote, "You said I was a liar. I'm not. If I were, I would have said I loved you, and I don't. People think you're good, but you're bad and hard-hearted. I will let everyone know what you've done." It is the voice of Iphigenia in Euripides' tragedy, of Scout in To Kill a Mockingbird, Frankie in A Member of the Wedding, Rahel in A God of Small Things, Claudia in The Bluest Eye, Tambu in Tsitsi Dangarembra's Nervous Condition, Annie John, You'll Tell Me About Spanish Novels. The list is endless. We know this voice, and yet it's hard not to hear this voice as girls themselves will come to describe it, that is, as rude or stupid, or to quote Anne Frank, as unpleasant and insufferable. The voice is culturally inflected but clearly recognizable. A girl on the edge of adolescence, of becoming a young woman, sees what she's facing and says what she sees. Children must be corrected, Anne Reed tells Jane in Charlotte Bronte's novel, to which Jane responds, "Deceit is not my problem." Yes. This is precisely the issue. Yet once the correction is made, few people ask, where is that honest voice? Thus, millions of readers, myself included, read Anne Frank's diary without realizing that what we were reading was not Anne's diary, but a version of the diary that she edited after hearing on Radio Free Orange, that was broadcasting from London into the Netherlands, that the Dutch government in exile had plans to set up a war museum after the war, and they were interested in diaries, letters, and sermons that would give a sense of how the Dutch people carried on their lives under the harsh conditions of the war. Anne wanted to be a famous writer. She seized her chance, rewriting over 300 pages of her diary between May and August of 1944. Her edited version is what most of us read, without missing what Anne had left out, that is, her pleasure in her own changing body with its, quote, sweet secrets, her pleasure with her mother and sister, quote, "Mummy Margot and I are thick as thieves again," and her awareness that the stories adults tell children, especially stories about marriage and purity, are, quote, nothing more than eyewash. Anne knew what she was doing and why. She wanted her diary to be chosen. The brilliance of dissociation as a response to trauma is that what is dissociated, split off from consciousness, and held out of awareness is not lost. As the poet Evan Boland writes, what we lost is here in this room on this veiled evening. When dissociation gives way to association, the stream of consciousness, the touch of relationship, we have the sensation of coming upon something at once familiar and surprising, something we know and yet didn't know that we knew. In When Boys Become, Quote, Boys, Judy Chu brings the eye of a naturalist to a study of 4 and 5 year old boys, observing them as they move from pre-kindergarten through kindergarten and into first grade. She witnesses them becoming, quote, boys. The pre-kindergarten boys who had been so articulate, so attentive, so authentic and direct in their relationships with one another and with her, were becoming gradually more inarticulate, more inattentive, more inauthentic and indirect with one another and with her. They were becoming, quote, boys. Chu saw boys' resistance to this initiation in their, quote, strategic concealment of their capacity for empathy, their emotional intelligence and sensitivity, and their desire for closeness. Boys' relational capacities are not lost, she writes, quote, rather boys' socialization toward cultural constructions of masculinity that are defined in opposition to femininity seems mainly to force a split between what boys know and what boys show. Winning the boys' trust, Chu learned about, quote, the mean team, a club created by the boys, for the boys, and for the stated purpose of acting against the girls. The mean team established a masculinity defined in opposition to and as the opposite of a femininity associated with being good and nice. Thus, the main activity of the mean team, this is the 4 and 5 year olds, was to, quote, bother people. Chu observes that the very relational capacities boys learn to shield, the empathy and emotional sensitivity that lead them to read the human world around them so accurately and astutely, are essential if they're to realize the closeness they now seek with other boys. Yet in blunting or shielding or concealing these capacities in order to become one of the boys, they render that closeness unattainable. In the epilogue to 13 Ways of Looking at a Man, the psychoanalyst Donald Moss recalls what Chu observed. When he was in first grade, they learned a new song every week and were told that at the end of the year, they would each have a chance to sing, lead the class in singing their favorite song, which they were to keep secret. For Moss, the choice was clear. Quote, the only song I loved was the lullaby. When at night I go to sleep, 13 angels watch do keep, from Hansel and Gretel. Every night he would sing it to himself, and like the song said, the angels came, saving him from his night terrors and enabling him to fall asleep. It was, quote, and would always be the most beautiful song I had ever heard. They had learned the song in early autumn, and in late spring, when his turn came, he stood in front of the class. The teacher asked what song he had chosen. Moss remembers, quote, I began to tell her it's the lullaby. But immediately, out of the corner of my eye, I saw the reaction of the boys in the front row. Their faces were lighting up in shock. I knew in a way that was immediate, clear, and certain that what I was about to do, the song I was about to choose, the declaration I was about to make represented an enormous, irrevocable error. What the boys were teaching me was that I was to know now and to always have known that When at Night I Go to Sleep could not be my favorite song, that a lullaby had no place here, that something else was called for. In a flash, in an act of gratitude, not to my angels, but to my boys, I changed my selection. I smiled at the teacher, told her I was just kidding. I told her that I would now lead the class in singing the Marines hymn from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. Moss writes that his book, quote, can be thought of as an extended effort to unpack that moment in front of the class and indirectly to apologize to the angels for my treachery. he had been, quote, unfaithful to them, had, quote, renounced them in public and continued to do so for many years. The residue was a melancholia tied to the boy's awareness that what he is, quote, really doing in that fateful turning outward is simultaneously preserving and betraying his original love of angels, affirming and denying his new love of boys. After all, now he and the boys are joined together in looking elsewhere for the angels they might have all once had. Yet in spite of his treachery, the angels, quote, are still there. Moss shows us with stunning precision how initiation leads to a rewriting of history. I was to know now, he writes, and to always have known that a lullaby could not be my favorite song, and yet it was, and, quote, always would be. Part 3, The Love Loss. In an overlooked passage, midway through Tolstoy's novel, Anna Karenina, we hear the hushed voice of Karenin. Quote, prior to the day when he saw his dying wife, he had not known his own heart. Like Hawthorne in his novel, The Scarlet Letter, Tolstoy, in Anna Karenina, takes us into the territory of the love laws. In The Scarlet Letter, the word patriarchy appears repeatedly. Patriarchal privilege, patriarchal personage, patriarchal power, along with a portrait of the father of the custom house, the patriarch, who, quote, and this is Hawthorne, had no soul, no heart, no mind. In this, he resembles Karenin, also a government official. The central characters, Anna Karenina and Hester Prynne, are so dazzling, so vibrant, that our eye fixes on them. They stand out among the women, the, quote, good wives, who are gray and muted by comparison. Anna and Hester are women who break the love laws, driven by a, quote, lawless passion. We want to know what happens to them. It is almost as if they serve to distract us from seeing what Tolstoy and Hawthorne are showing us about what happens to men in patriarchy. The names of Hawthorne's central male characters, Dimmesdale and Chillingworth, give us a clue. Yet Hester's Scarlet A so rivets our attention that we may miss the implied questions, how does a man of worth, Mr. Chillingworth, become chilling? How does a man of nature, Mr. Dimmesdale, become dim? It's Tolstoy who takes us to the core. Anna is due to give birth to the child she conceived with her lover, Vronsky. Deathly ill, she sends a telegram to her husband, begging him to come and forgive her so she can die in peace. He assumes it's a trick and feels only contempt. Yet he's concerned that if he doesn't go and she dies, it would, quote, not only be cruel and everyone could condemn me, but it would be stupid on my part. So he goes. Readers often forget or don't quite take in that at this juncture in the novel, Karenin offers to give Anna both her freedom and her son. He will divorce her and, by taking the disgrace on himself, make it possible for her to go into society and to keep Seryozha with her. As it turns out, Anna does not take the offer. Her decision is unexplained. In a novel where we're told what even the dog thinks, Anna's refusal to take her freedom, the refusal that seals her fate, is conveyed cryptically in a short paragraph. Quote, a month later, Alexei Alexandrovich was left alone in his apartment with his son, and Anna went abroad with Vronsky without obtaining a divorce and resolutely abandoning the idea. We are, however, told in great detail what happened to Karenin when, at his wife's bedside, quote, he had given himself for the first time in his life to that feeling of tender compassion which other people's suffering evoked in him and which he had previously been ashamed of as a bad weakness. He suddenly felt, quote, not only relief from his suffering, but also an inner peace that he had never experienced before. He suddenly felt that the very thing that had once been the source of his suffering had become the source of his spiritual joy, that what had seemed insoluble when he condemned, reproached, and hated became simple and clear when he forgave and loved. Karenin settles into his household. He begins to observe the people around him, the wet nurse, the government, and his son. He regrets that he hadn't paid much attention to him. Now he stroked the boy's hair with his hand. For the newborn little girl, quote, he had some special feeling, not only of pity, but also of tenderness. He did not know how he came to love her. He would sometimes spend half an hour silently gazing at the saffron-red, downy, wrinkled cheek of the sleeping baby and felt utterly at peace and in harmony with himself and saw nothing extraordinary in his situation, nothing that needed to be changed. But, quote, the more time that passed, the more clearly he saw that natural as this situation was for him, he would not be allowed to remain in it. He felt that beside the good spiritual force that had guided his soul, there was another force, crude and equally powerful, if not more so, that guided his life, and that this force would not give him the humble peace he desired. He felt that everybody looked at him with questioning surprise, not understanding him and expecting something from him. Over a stretch of 15 pages, Tolstoy repeats the phrases, crude force, powerful force, mysterious force, as though to make sure they stay in our mind like Vronsky's strong white teeth. In the face of this force, Karenin feels powerless. Quote, he knew beforehand that everything was against him and that he would not be allowed to do what now seemed to him so natural and good, but would be forced to do what was bad, but would seem to them the proper thing. What seemed to Karenin natural and good becomes in the eyes of the world bad and improper. The crude, powerful, mysterious force, which contrary to his inner mood guided his life, demanding the carrying out of his will, which led Karenin to feel ashamed about, quote, that feeling of tender compassion which other people's suffering evoked in him, and to regard it as a bad weakness, is patriarchy. Anna had broken the love laws. But in doing so, she freed love, her own, and as it turns out, also that of Karenin. We learn that Karenin had been an orphan, his childhood bleak. His pursuit of status and honor appear in this light as an attempt to fill an inner void. He was a man afraid of feeling, cut off from love, ashamed of his humanity, until suddenly, also a repeated word in this passage, his heart opens in response to Anna and the baby, an opening he experiences as simple, clear, natural, and good. He writes to Anna, tell me yourself what will give you true happiness and peace in your soul. I give myself over entirely to your will and your sense of justice. In this moment, they appear simply as human. He with emotions of tenderness and compassion, she with will and a sense of justice. But the world they live in is ruled by a crude force. Karenin sacrifices his love, Anna sacrifices her will and her desire for freedom, and with these sacrifices, the tragedy becomes inescapable. Once Anna leaves without obtaining a divorce, once she gives up the freedom she wanted and that could have made her life with Vronsky viable, enabling her, like him, to go out into society and not separating her from her son, it's a straight line to her death under the train. Love is the force that has the power to upset a patriarchal order. Crossing its boundaries, in Arundhati Roy's novel, an untouchable man touches a touchable woman. It dismantles its hierarchies of race, class, caste, sexuality, and gender. Thus, love must be betrayed or lead to tragedy for patriarchy to continue. Hence the love laws, hence the association of patriarchy with trauma and moral injury, because as Tolstoy shows us in the character of Karenin, the betrayal of love is a betrayal of what's right. The privileged position of men in patriarchy can blind us from seeing what these novelists show us. The devoted resistance, the resistance that comes from within rather than from someone who stands outside the culture, is the resistance of Vronsky, Anna's lover, who repeatedly turns down opportunities to rejoin his regiment and rise in the hierarchy, choosing instead to be with Anna. In this respect, he is like Shakespeare's Antony, who, speaking of Egypt and Cleopatra, says, quote, let Rome in Tiber melt, here is my place. Tolstoy and Hawthorne tell a dominant story. They show us the price of freeing love within a patriarchal order, but also the cost of its containment. In the hushed voices of the men, we hear the signs of moral injury when they are forced to betray what's right in a high-stakes situation, a betrayal sanctioned in the eyes of the world as good and proper. Love, Hawthorne writes, whether newly born or aroused from a death-like slumber, must always create sunshine, filling the heart so full of radiance that it overflows upon the outward world. He also observes, quote, no man for any considerable period can wear one face to himself and another to the multitude without finally getting bewildered as to which may be the true. Conclusion, the ethic of care. It is difficult in this postmodern age to speak of an honest voice or true face. Respect for cultural differences has similarly complicated the search for moral truth. Can we uphold the value of individual liberty and religious freedom while maintaining a commitment to human rights? In these discussions, the situation of women repeatedly comes to the fore. Can a democratic society sanction or turn a blind eye to the subordination of women in patriarchy? One way to advance the discussion of ethics is to begin by talking about listening. Listening in a way that creates trust. Then talk about moral injury and the ethic of care, how it can guide us in preventing the betrayal of what's right. With the paradigm shift in the human sciences, we can recognize the extent to which we have mistaken patriarchy for nature and fail to see what the Arab Spring demonstrated so viscerally. The desire to have a voice and to live democratically is a human desire. In Egypt, the presence of women in Tahrir Square was striking, and their subsequent absence from public life suggests that women are the weather vane in the struggle between democracy and patriarchy, showing which way the wind is blowing. The love laws are no small thing, and we need to fight them, not acquiesce in the separation of women's rights from human rights, or relegate women to a special sphere where equality becomes uncertain and rights don't apply. Knowing that the private sphere is where women are most at risk, it's unconscionable not to speak out and watch out for women's rights and women's safety. Sarah Hurdy observes that the patriarchal family is neither traditional nor original in an evolutionary sense. However natural it may appear, however God-given it is said to be, as Hurdy writes, quote, patriarchal ideologies that focus on the chastity of women and the perpetuation and augmentation of male lineages undercut the long-standing priority of putting children's well-being first. Care is a feminist, not a feminine issue, ethic. And feminism, guided by the ethic of care, is arguably the most radical in the sense of going to the roots liberation movement in human history. Released from the gender binary and hierarchy, feminism is not a woman's issue or a battle between women and men. It is the movement to free democracy from patriarchy. The Laguna Pueblo poet and scholar Paula Gunn Allen writes, "The root of oppression is the loss of memory." In a Different Voice, identified the reclaiming of voice as a pivot, a turning point in women's development. It followed the recognition that selflessness, long seen as the epitome of feminine goodness, is in fact morally problematic. It signifies an abdication of voice and an evasion of responsibility and relationship. My interviews with pregnant women who were considering abortion took place in the immediate aftermath of the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Roe v. Wade. When the highest court in the land gave women a decisive voice, it encouraged women to scrutinize the sacrifice of voice in the name of goodness. Janet, one of the women interviewed, articulates this shift in her thinking when concerns about goodness are joined by a concern about truth. You have to know what you're doing, Janet says. You have to be, quote, truthful, not hiding anything, bringing out all the feelings involved before you can know if what you're doing is, quote, a good decision and an honest one, a real decision. A comparable turning point in men's development occurs when a man realizes he has been living a lie and scrutinizes the betrayal of love in the name of honor or manhood. Donald Moss reflects that he had been unfaithful to his angels, had, quote, renounced them in public and continued to do so for many years. But he had also been unfaithful to himself, because in truth, the lullaby was his favorite song. The ethic of care guides us in acting carefully in the human world and underscores the costs of carelessness, of not paying attention, not listening, being absent rather than present, not responding with integrity and respect. In the documentary film The Gatekeepers, six former heads of Shin Bet, Israel's internal security served in silence, a voice under political or religious or psychological constraint. How can I listen in women for the honest voice of the 11-year-old girl, or in men for the emotionally intelligent 4-year-old boy? What are the resonances that can summon dissociated experiences back into awareness? Like love, art has the power to cross boundaries and open doors that have seemingly been nailed shut. What happens when we replace judgment with curiosity? Rather than putting ourselves in the shoes of another, we would do better to put on our shoes and go to the other to learn from them about their place. I conclude with Jonathan Shea, quote, if we want to live among equals with strength and candor, among people with, as Euripides says, free and generous eyes, the understanding of trauma can form a solid basis for a science of human rights. As Shea says, the vision of a good life for a human being is an ethical choice and cannot be coerced. It can only be called forth by persuasion, education, and welcoming appeal. Thank you very much.